The Mystery of the Blue Train, Agatha Christie. Chapter 19, An Unexpected Visitor. The Comte de la Roche had just finished déjeuner, consisting of an omelette fines herbes, an entrecote béarnaise, and a savarin au rhum. Wiping his fine black mustache delicately with his table napkin, the Comte rose from the table. He passed through the salon of the villa, noting with appreciation the few objets d'art which were carelessly scattered about. The Louis XV snuff box, the satin shoe worn by Marie Antoinette, and the other historic trifles that were part of the Comte's mise en scène. They were, he would explain to his fair visitors, heirlooms in his family. Passing through onto the terrace, the Comte looked out onto the Mediterranean with an unseeing eye. He was in no mood for appreciating the beauties of scenery. A fully matured scheme had been rudely brought to naught, and his plans had to be cast afresh. Stretching himself out in a basket chair, a cigarette held between his white fingers, the Comte pondered deeply. Presently, Hippolyte, his manservant, brought out coffee and a choice of liqueur. The Comte selected some very fine old brandy. As the manservant was preparing to depart, the Comte arrested him with a slight gesture. Hippolyte stood respectfully to attention. His countenance was hardly a prepossessing one, but the correctitude of his demeanor went far to obliterate the fact. He was now the picture of respectful attention. "It is possible," said the Comte, "that in the course of the next few days, various strangers may come to the house. They will endeavor to scrape acquaintance with you and with Marie. They will probably ask you various questions concerning me." "Yes, Monsieur le Comte." "Perhaps this has already happened." "No, Monsieur le Comte." "There have been no strangers about the place, you're certain?" "There has been no one, Monsieur le Comte." "That is well," said the Comte dryly. "Nevertheless, they will come. I'm sure of it. They will ask questions." Hippolyte looked at his master in intelligent anticipation. The Comte spoke slowly, without looking at Hippolyte. "As you know, I arrived here last Tuesday morning. If the police or any other inquirer should question you, do not forget that fact. I arrived on Tuesday, the 14th, not Wednesday the 15th. You understand?" "Perfectly, Monsieur le Comte." "In an affair where a lady is concerned, it is always necessary to be discreet. I feel certain, Hippolyte, that you can be discreet."
"I can be discreet, Monsieur."
"And Marie?"
"Marie also. I will answer for her."
"That is well, then," murmured the Comte. When Hippolyte had withdrawn, the Comte sipped his black coffee with a reflective air. Occasionally he frowned. Once he shook his head slightly. Twice he nodded it. Into the midst of these cogitations came Hippolyte once more.
"A lady, Monsieur."
"A lady?" The Comte was surprised. Not that a visit from a lady was an unusual thing at the Villa Marina, but at this particular moment the Comte could not think who the lady was likely to be.
"She is, I think, a lady not known to Monsieur," murmured the valet helpfully.
The Comte was more and more intrigued. "Show her out here, Hippolyte," he commanded. A moment later, a marvelous vision in orange and black stepped out in the terrace, accompanied by a strong perfume of exotic blossoms.
"Monsieur le Comte de la Roche."
"At your service, mademoiselle," said the Comte, bowing.
"My name is Morel. You may have heard of me."
"Ah, indeed, mademoiselle. But who has not been enchanted by the dancing of Mademoiselle Morel? Exquisite." The dancer acknowledged this compliment with a brief, mechanical smile.
"My descent upon you is unceremonious," she began.
"But seat yourself, I beg of you, mademoiselle," cried the Comte,
bringing forward a chair. Behind the gallantry of his manner, he was observing her narrowly. There were very few things that the Comte did not know about women. True, his experience had not lain much in ladies of Morel's class, who were themselves predatory. He and the dancer were, in a sense, birds of a feather. His arts, the Comte knew, would be thrown away on Morel. She was a Parisienne, and a shrewd one. Nevertheless, there was one thing that the Comte could recognize infallibly when he saw it. He knew at once that he was in the presence of a very angry woman. And an angry woman, as the Comte was well aware, always says more than is prudent, and is occasionally a source of profit to a level-headed gentleman who keeps his cool. It is most amiable of you, mademoiselle, to honor my poor abode thus. We have mutual friends in Paris, said Morel. I've heard of you from them, but I come to see you today for another reason. I have heard of you since I came to Nice, in a different way, you understand.
Ah? Said the Comte softly.
I'll be brutal, continued the dancer. Nevertheless, believe that I have your welfare at heart. They're saying in Nice, Monsieur le Comte, that you are the murderer of an English lady, Madame Kettering.
I? The murderer of Madame Kettering? Bah! But how absurd!
He spoke more languidly than indignantly, knowing that he would thus provoke her further. But yes, she insisted, it is as I tell you. It amuses people to talk, murmured the Comte indifferently. It would be beneath me to take such wild accusations seriously. You do not understand, Morel bent forward, her dark eyes flashing. It is not the idle talk of those in the street. It's the police.
The police? Ah!
The Comte sat up, alert once more. Morel nodded her head vigorously several times.
Yes, yes, you comprehend me. I have friends everywhere. The prefect himself.
She left the sentence unfinished, with an eloquent shrug of the shoulders. Who is not indiscreet where a beautiful woman is concerned? Murmured the Count politely. The police believe that you killed Madame Kettering, but they're wrong.
Certainly they're wrong, agreed the Comte easily.
You say that, but you don't know the truth.
I do.
The Comte looked at her curiously. You know who killed Madame Kettering? Is that what you would say, mademoiselle? Morel nodded vehemently.
Yes.
Who was it? Asked the Comte sharply.
Her husband.
She leant across to the Comte, speaking in a low voice that vibrated with anger and excitement.
It was her husband who killed her.
The Comte leaned back in his chair. His face was a mask.
Let me ask you, mademoiselle, how do you know this?
How do I know it? Morel sprang to her feet with a laugh.
He boasted of it beforehand. He was ruined, bankrupt, dishonored. Only the death of his wife could save him. He told me so. He traveled on the same train, but she was not to know it. Why was that, I ask you? So that he might creep upon her in the night?
Ah! She shut her eyes. I can see it happening. The Count coughed.
Perhaps, he murmured. But surely, mademoiselle, in that case, he would not steal the jewels.
The jewels, breathed Morel.
The jewels, ah, those rubies.
Her eyes grew misty, a faraway light in them. The Comte looked at her curiously, wondering for the 100th time at the magical influence of precious stones on the female sex. He recalled her to practical matters. What do you want me to do, mademoiselle? Morel became alert and businesslike once more.
Surely it is simple. You will go to the police. You will say to them that Monsieur Kettering committed this crime.
And if they don't believe me? If they ask for proof? He was eyeing her closely.
Morel laughed softly and drew her orange and black wrap closer around her.
Send them to me, Monsieur le Comte, she said softly. I will give them the proof they want.
Upon that, she was gone, an impetuous whirlwind, her errand accomplished. The Comte looked after her,
his eyebrows delicately raised. "She's in a fury," he murmured. "What has happened now to upset her? But she shows her hand too plainly. Does she really believe that Mr. Kettering killed his wife? She would like me to believe it. She would even like the police to believe it." He smiled to himself. He had no intention whatsoever of going to the police. He saw various other possibilities, to judge by his smile, an agreeable vista of them. Presently, however, his brow clouded. According to Morrell, he was suspected by the police. That might be true or it might not. An angry woman of the type of the dancer was not likely to bother about the strict veracity of her statements. On the other hand, she might easily have obtained inside information. In that case, his mouth set grimly, in that case he must take certain precautions. He went into the house and questioned Hippolyte closely once more as to whether any strangers had been to the house. The valet was positive in his assurances that this was not the case. The comte went up to his bedroom and crossed over to an old bureau that stood against the wall. He let down the lid of this, and his delicate finger sought for a spring at the back of one of the pigeonholes. A secret drawer flew out. In it was a small brown paper package. The comte took this out and weighed it in his hand carefully for a minute or two. Raising his hand to his head, with a slight grimace, he pulled out a single hair. This he placed on the lip of the drawer and shut it carefully. Still carrying the small parcel in his hand, he went downstairs and out of the house to the garage, where stood a scarlet two-seater car. 10 minutes later, he had taken the road for Monte Carlo. He spent a few hours at the casino, then sauntered out into the town. Presently, he re-entered the car and drove off in the direction of Mentone. Earlier in the afternoon, he had noticed an inconspicuous gray car some little distance behind him. He noticed it again now. He smiled to himself. The road was climbing steadily upwards. The comte's foot pressed hard on the accelerator. The little red car had been specially built to the comte's design and had a far more powerful engine than would have been suspected from its appearance. It shot ahead. Presently, he looked back and smiled. The gray car was following behind. Smothered in dust, the little red car leaped along the road. It was traveling now at a dangerous pace, but the comte was a first-class driver. Now they were going downhill, twisting and curving unceasingly. Presently, the car slackened speed and finally came to a standstill before a bureau de poste. The comte jumped out, lifted the lid of the tool chest, extracted the small brown paper parcel, and hurried into the post office. 2 minutes later, he was driving once more in the direction of Mentone. When the gray car arrived there, the comte was drinking English 5 o'clock tea on the terrace of one of the hotels. Later, he drove back to Monte Carlo, dined there, and reached home once more at 11 o'clock. Hippolyte came out to meet him with a disturbed face. "Ah, Monsieur le Comte has arrived. Monsieur le Comte did not telephone me, by any chance?" The Comte shook his head. "And yet at 3 o'clock I received a summons from Monsieur le Comte to present myself to him at Nice, at the Negresco." "Really?" said the Comte. "And you went?" "Certainly, monsieur. But at the Negresco they knew nothing of Monsieur le Comte. He had not been there." "Ah," said the Comte. Doubtless at that hour Marie was out doing her afternoon marketing. "That is so, Monsieur le Comte." "Ah, well," said the Comte, "it's of no importance. A mistake." He went upstairs, smiling to himself. Once within his own room, he bolted his door and looked sharply round. Everything seemed as usual. He opened various drawers and cupboards. Then he nodded to himself. Things had been replaced almost exactly as he'd left them, but not quite. It was evident that a very thorough search had been made. He went over to the bureau and pressed the hidden spring. The drawer flew open, but the hair was no longer where he'd placed it. He nodded his head several times. "They are excellent, our French police," he murmured to himself. "Excellent. Nothing escapes them." Chapter 20. Catherine Makes a Friend. On the following morning, Catherine and Lennox were sitting on the terrace of the Villa Marguerite. Something in the nature of a friendship was springing up between them, despite the difference in age. But for Lennox, Catherine would have found life at the Villa Marguerite quite intolerable. The Kettering case was the topic of the moment. Lady Tamplin frankly exploited her guest's connection with the affair for all it was worth. The most persistent rebuffs that Catherine could administer quite failed to pierce Lady Tamplin's self-esteem. Lennox adopted a detached attitude, seemingly amused at her mother's maneuvers, and yet with a sympathetic understanding of Catherine's feelings. The situation was not helped by Chubby, whose naive delight was unquenchable, and who introduced Catherine to all and sundry as, "This is Miss Gray. You know, that Blue Train business? She was in it up to the ears. Had a long talk with Ruth Kettering a few hours before the murder. Bit of luck for her, eh?" A few remarks of this kind had provoked Catherine that morning to an unusually tart rejoinder, and when they were alone together, Lennox observed in her slow drawl, "Not used to exploitation, are you? You have a lot to learn, Catherine." "I'm sorry I lost my temper. I don't, as a rule." "It's about time you learnt to blow off steam. Chubby is only an ass. There's no harm in him. Mother, of course, is trying, but you can lose your temper with her until kingdom come, and it won't make any impression. She'll open large, sad blue eyes at you and not care a bit." Catherine made no reply to this filial observation, and Lennox presently went on. "I'm rather like Chubby. I delight in a good murder, and besides, well, knowing Derek makes a difference." Catherine nodded. "So you lunched with him yesterday," pursued Lennox reflectively. "Do you like him, Catherine?" Catherine considered for a minute or two. "I don't know," she said very slowly. "He's very attractive." "Yes, he is attractive. What don't you like about him?" Catherine didn't reply to the question, or at any rate not directly. "He spoke of his wife's death," she said. "He said he would not pretend that it had been anything but a bit of most marvelous luck for him." "And that shocked you, I suppose," said Lennox. She paused and then added in rather a queer tone of voice, "He likes you, Catherine." "He gave me a very good lunch," said Catherine, smiling. Lennox refused to be sidetracked. "I saw it the night he came here," she said thoughtfully, "the way he looked at you. And you're not his usual type, just the opposite. Well, I suppose it's like religion. You get it at a certain age." "Mademoiselle is wanted at the telephone," said Marie, appearing at the window of the salon. "Monsieur Hercule Poirot desires to speak with her." More blood and thunder. "Go on, Catherine. Go and dally with your detective." Monsieur Hercule Poirot's voice came neat and precise in its intonation to Catherine's ear. "This is Mademoiselle Gray who speaks." "Bon. Mademoiselle, I have a word for you from Monsieur Van Alden, the father of Madame Kettering. He wishes very much to speak with you, either at the Villa Marguerite or at his hotel, whichever you prefer." Catherine reflected for a moment, but she decided that for Van Alden to come to the Villa Marguerite would be both painful and unnecessary. Lady Tamplin would have hailed his advent with far too much delight. She never lost a chance to cultivate millionaires. She told Poirot that she would much rather come to Nice. "Excellent, mademoiselle. I will call for you myself in an auto. Shall we say in about 3/4 of an hour? Punctually to the moment, Poirot appeared. Catherine was waiting for him, and they drove off at once. "Well, mademoiselle, how goes it?" She looked at his twinkling eyes and was confirmed in her first impression that there was something very attractive about Monsieur Hercule Poirot. "This is your own Roman Policier, is it not?" said Poirot. "I made you the promise that we should study it together. And me, I always keep my promises." "You are too kind," murmured Catherine. "Ah, you mock yourself at me. But do you want to hear the developments of the case, or do you not?" Catherine admitted that she did, and Poirot proceeded to sketch for her a thumbnail portrait of the Comte de la Roche. "You think he killed her," said Catherine thoughtfully. That is the theory, said Poirot guardedly. Do you yourself believe that?
I did not say so. And you, mademoiselle, what do you think?
Catherine shook her head.
How should I know? I don't know anything about these things. But I should say that...
Yes, said Poirot encouragingly.
Well, from what you say, the Count doesn't sound like the kind of man who would actually kill anybody.
Ah, very good, cried Poirot. You agree with me. That is just what I have said. He looked at her sharply. But tell me, you have met Monsieur Derek Kettering.
I met him at Lady Tamplin's, and I lunched with him yesterday.
Ah, mauvais sujet, said Poirot, shaking his head. But les femmes, they like that, eh?
He twinkled at Catherine, and she laughed. He's the kind of man one would notice anywhere, continued Poirot.
Doubtless you observed him on the blue train.
Yes, I noticed him.
In the restaurant car?
No.
I didn't notice him at meals at all. I only saw him once, going into his wife's compartment.
Poirot nodded.
A strange business, he murmured.
I believe you said you were awake, mademoiselle, and looked out of your window at Lyon. You saw no tall, dark man such as Comte de la Roche leave the train.
Catherine shook her head.
I don't think I saw anyone at all, she said. There was a youngish lad in a cap and overcoat who got out, but I don't think he was leaving the train, only walking up and down the platform. There was a fat Frenchman with a beard, in pajamas and an overcoat, who wanted a cup of coffee. Otherwise, I think there were only the train attendants.
Poirot nodded his head several times.
It is like this, you see, he confided. The Comte de la Roche has an alibi. An alibi is a very pestilential thing and always open to the gravest suspicion. But here we are. They went straight up to Fenalden's suite, where they found Knighton. Poirot introduced him to Catherine. After a few commonplaces had been exchanged, Knighton said, I'll tell Mr. Fenalden that Miss Gray is here. He went through a second door into an adjoining room. There was a low murmur of voices, and then Fenalden came into the room and advanced towards Catherine with outstretched hand, giving her at the same time a shrewd and penetrating glance.
I am pleased to meet you, Miss Gray, he said simply. I've been wanting very badly to hear what you can tell me about Ruth.
The quiet simplicity of the millionaire's manner appealed to Catherine strongly. She felt herself in the presence of a very genuine grief, the more real for its absence of outward sign. He drew forward a chair.
Sit here, will you, and just tell me all about it.
Poirot and Knighton retired discreetly into the other room, and Catherine and Fenalden were left alone together. She found no difficulty in her task. Quite simply and naturally, she related her conversation with Ruth Kettering, word for word as nearly as she could. He listened in silence, leaning back in his chair, with one hand shading his eyes. When she'd finished, he said quietly, "Thank you, my dear." They both sat silent for a minute or two. Catherine felt that words of sympathy would be out of place. When the millionaire spoke, it was in a different tone.
"I'm very grateful to you, Miss Gray. I think you did something to ease my poor Ruth's mind in the last hours of life. Now I want to ask you something. You know, Monsieur Poirot will have told you about the scoundrel that my poor girl had got herself mixed up with. He was the man of whom she spoke to you, the man she was going to meet. In your judgment, do you think she might have changed her mind after conversation with you? Do you think she meant to go back on her word?"
"I can't honestly tell you. She had certainly come to some decision, and seemed more cheerful in consequence of it."
"She gave you no idea where she intended to meet the skunk, whether in Paris or in Hyères?"
Catherine shook her head.
"She said nothing as to that."
"Ah," said Fenalden thoughtfully. "And that is the important point. Well, time will show."
He got up and opened the door of the adjoining room. Poirot and Knighton came back. Catherine declined the millionaire's invitation to lunch, and Knighton went down with her and saw her into the waiting car.
He returned to find Poirot and Fanaldin deep in conversation.
"If we only knew," said the millionaire thoughtfully, "what decision Ruth came up to. It might have been any of half a dozen. She might have meant to leave the train at Paris and cable to me. She may have meant to have gone on to the south of France and have an explanation with the Count there. We're in the dark, absolutely in the dark. But we have the maid's word for it that she was both startled and dismayed at the Count's appearance at the station in Paris. That was clearly not part of the preconceived plan. You agree with me, Knighton?"
The secretary started.
"I beg your pardon, Mr. Fanaldin. I wasn't listening."
"Daydreaming, eh?" said Fanaldin.
"That's not like you. I believe that girl has bowled you over."
Knighton blushed.
"She is a remarkably nice girl," said Fanaldin thoughtfully.
"Very nice. Did you happen to notice her eyes?"
"Any man," said Knighton, "would be bound to notice her eyes."